The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show. It is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Are there ever winners in strikes? Are there? I don't think there are winners in today's strike. Unions putting a brave face on the fact that they took workers off the job for 8 days. 8 days, no work, no pay. Big promises of the 5.9% increase, which was on the table before the unions took their workers out on strike, their members out on strike. And then there's a promise of back pay and a promise of more pay. And if there are more ifs in there than there are in a Rudyard Kipling poem. We'll talk to Professor Nicola Klein this evening. We set her up to talk about her, about the ethics barometer, which they announced this week. But it is coincidental that we report this evening the death of Sir Donald Gordon, the man who founded Liberty in 1956 and then went on to found Liberty International in the United Kingdom, which then split into two different property companies, which have had their trials and tribulations in recent years. But in his day, was one of the great rand hedges for South African investors on the JSE. Then Donald Gordon also made huge bequests available to the likes of Gibbs, to the Kenridge Hospital, which became the Donald Gordon Medical Hospital. So yes, lots of contributions. We'll play the best bits of the Money Show and, of course, wrap it all up this evening with the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious.
Well, the SAA strike is over. The wage settlement is littered, as I said, with ifs, buts and maybes. Guy Leach, the managing editor at SA Flyer magazine. Can anybody in this dispute claim it was worth it, Guy Leach?
Oh, absolutely not, Bruce. You're 100% right in your introduction. There have been no winners in this one whatsoever. The damage to SAA goes far beyond just 8 days of reduced revenue. The real problem is that the airline was pretty much already on its knees, and this has probably pushed it over the edge for many potential funders, and even worse, for corporate travel agents and what have you, who might be booking seats in 6 months' time and therefore wondering whether the airline will still exist. There's been so much noise about from government, pushback from government saying, don't strike, we'll close it down, that the very existence of the airline is now seriously in question. And why would anyone want to book on an airline that might be around, might not be around in 4, 5, 6 months' time, especially when there are such good options like, you know, Ethiopian and Kenyan and the European airlines, and not to mention the Middle East three.
And this is the problem that SAA faces, is that a loss of confidence, and, you know, you're asking me to put good money down in order to fund my trip in March, April, May next year, and I'm going to say to you, well, if I want certainty, and it's slightly less convenient to get to Frankfurt via Dubai, it takes a bit longer, but actually I can be certain that my ticket will be honored, or I can do it on British Airways, or I can do it on multiple other airlines. SAA is losing its competitive advantage there. Until we have any certainty of the SAA's future, and there's no certainty at all, it is a lame duck, dead duck. What is it?
Yeah, but it's not just the certainty of the future flights, it's the goodwill. The airline has been reliant on the goodwill of the public to keep it going for whatever misguided notions there may be in having a flag carrier or having created 10,000 jobs and all the associated jobs and the prestige and the connectivity in terms of routes flown and this sort of stuff. It all doesn't add up to much. So the goodwill was absolutely vital. I think that one of the fallouts of a strike like this is that goodwill also perishes fairly fast. People got stranded. There will be resentment from the employees who actually have taken quite a big hit in terms of loss of income for the sake of a relatively non-existent gain, because, as you pointed out, all the promises are, well, if we have money in 3 months' time, 4 months' time, then we'll pay you. And I think the chances of that are fairly slight at this stage. So a lot of goodwill lost as well.
And then we look at the competitive environment. I mean, domestically this week, and I went through airports a couple of times this week as part of an exercise to see what was going on, other airlines seemed to mop up SAA's customers. There weren't people sort of hanging around waiting for flights that didn't happen, other than yesterday afternoon in Joburg when the storms caused havoc, but that was storm-related and AXA failure-related. SAA was barely missed, dare I suggest.
Absolutely. In fact, That's the reality that we've seen from the strike. Internationally, the routes were only affected over the week, over last weekend. And they were able to get the routes back. In fact, they didn't lose more than half of their flights. Regionally, it took another 2 or 3 days to get pretty much full service back. And domestically, the Mango was able to gear up a whole lot. The airline was able to bring in a couple of leased, what they call wet leased, aircraft from our Tambo operator Global, which they were able to fill with seats and cabin crew and pilots. So a lot of those routes were able to be flown as well. Passengers were put on Airlink, which is associated with SAA, even Express, and of course Mango. So there wasn't that much pain endured by the actual airline passengers themselves. As I said, the real losers here were, I think, the staff, the employees on strike.
And unions celebrating the fact that retrenchments have been deferred to January, or discussions about retrenchments deferred to January. What this strike has done is make those more inevitable than ever before, following, what, 400 million rand in losses over the last 8 days. And, you know, the fact is that, you know, a couple of banks have stepped in and helped fund 2 billion rand in capital expenditure. But without a miracle, and without a plan, and without some hope, and maybe another government bailout, can you see this airline lasting beyond March?
No, let me not say that. Yes, I think that the government is committed to continuing to trickle feed the airline. The pilots have a phrase. They said they are expected to make small concessions, but you've drip feed a bucket with huge holes in it. Two things are changing. The first is that the airline is beginning to take delivery of brand new, or pretty much brand new, Airbus A350s, which will make routes that were not profitable profitable, particularly New York. The second is that I expect to see a new CEO in the first quarter of next year, and by all accounts, they have adhered to the job spec, which requires somebody with international airline turnaround experience, and that means it'll be a non-South African. I think that the third important factor is that I genuinely believe that Tito Mboweni and Pravin Gordhan have really run out of patience with the airline and are not really prepared to continue to take political or hits for the sake of political appeasement or keeping the comrades happy or whatever the agenda may be. So there is a real chance that the airline will now finally be turned around. But you know what? I think that everyone has obviously run out of patience here as well.
I can't wait to see NUMSA's response to an international, to a foreign CEO coming in after the reaction to André de Reiter's appointment at ESCOM this week. That's going to lead to all kinds of new fun and games, no doubt. But my thanks to you, Guy Leach, the managing editor at SA Flyer magazine.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Professor Nicola Klein joins us, the Dean at Gibbs. And before we talk to you about your ethics barometer, which you published this week, it's a sad day today from a national point of view. A lot of people won't know the name Donald Gordon. They may have heard of the hospital. They may have heard of the Gordon Institute of Business Science. But they won't know about Donald Gordon, the guy who in 1956 started Liberty, one of South Africa's oldest and longest running insurance companies, Nicola. I suppose today is particularly poignant for you. He's died at the age of 89.
Bruce, it is, but it's also an opportunity to celebrate a remarkable life. And really, his leadership has infused the school. When he opened the school in March 2000, he gave us some principles for business success. And when I look at them, one of the things that I love about what he says is he says, you won't be an overnight success. I mean, along these lines, you won't be an overnight success. He says, remember that overnight success usually takes about 15 years. And I thought, goodness, what kind of prescience. So maybe sometimes when we're all thinking about wanting a solution tomorrow, we need to hark back to Donald Gordon's wisdom. But we are very grateful. Without him, the school would not have been founded the way it has been. And, of course, we honor him in terms of the name of our school.
I mean, he made that bequest to the University of Pretoria, and the University of Pretoria, in return, renamed its business school the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Not only did he do that, but he did found Liberty. He brought unit trusts to South Africa. And no sooner had he done that and he then moved on, he went to go and found a second empire in Liberty International and made lots of money in the United Kingdom out of property deals. That was a great strength of his. Of course, we've got him to thank also for Sandton City, which was built in the middle of nowhere 50 years ago. He got himself knighted for services to the arts in the United Kingdom.
Yes, a broad-reaching man, you know, with a huge amount of depth and a generalist. But I look back at what he did in this mix between commercial savvy, pragmatism, and of course, a deep sense of ethics and concern for reputation. I think there are many lessons that we can take from these kinds of individuals as we think about how we embark on our national project. So it's a timely reminder for us, I think, to one, celebrate his life, but also to be focusing on some of the wisdoms in what he said.
No, yep, absolutely.
So we published it. We published a tribute to him briefly, and these principles for business success earlier on Twitter. So it's on our hashtag if anybody's interested in reading, because really there is so much wisdom and learning from him.
Yeah, and sometimes the old lessons are the best lessons. But I do like the overnight success story. It will take you about 15 years. That's if you crack it. If you crack it, there's no guarantees there either. Donald Gordon.
If you crack it, he even beat Sheryl Sandberg. You know, I see here on this list it says strive for excellence. Not perfection. And, you know, she was done is better than perfect. I thought, well, I think that's also balanced. You know, we can't be perfect, but we do need to constantly strive for excellence.
He should have been at his peak in a social media generation. He really should. I mean, a wise, you know, his wisdom, I think, is something that should be, people should be learning a lot more about. And it's quite difficult, I think, in sort of like when somebody has sort of not been in business for 20 years, their legacies are often forgotten. But not Donald Gordon's. He's left an enormous legacy in South Africa. Africa and beyond our borders. And legacy is a good segue, I suppose, to your ethics barometer, because a lot of people, when they're involved in the cut and thrust of business and doing what it is that they do, forget that they're going to be remembered one day, and they're either going to be remembered in a positive way or in a negative way. And ethics underpin, I suppose, that reputation.
They do, absolutely. One of the things that we've had to deal with in launching the barometer this week, and it's been a phenomenal process, and this is really Rabbi Gideon Pogren's brainchild. He started the ethics think tank and invited business schools from Harvard Business School, who started us and got us on the road thinking about how we could localize something, has been this assumption that organizations are either ethical or unethical. And I think just like human beings, as good as we might think ourselves to be, there are always areas for improvement. We're very conscious at Gibbs that, and very grateful to the 15 companies and the 8,000 respondents, in excess of 8,000, who've given us both answers to numeric answers, quantitative stuff, and then over 7,000 comments to go through, which gives us a sense of the state of some companies. But of course, it's always the more ethical companies who will put up their hands and say, come in and work with us and survey our employees. But we're very grateful that organizations, and it's been in support with BLSA, have taken this first step that gets us going on a road to actually start really diving into differences between what employees want and what they perceive from companies, and then also issues around intimidation, fear cultures, and for us to use this as a, not as a beauty contest for who's more ethical than somebody else, but really as a way to, I think, start a conversation that moves beyond we need ethics into what are the specific dimensions of ethical behavior, what do our employees really think, and how do we engage with them on it?
What have you learned from these contributions from these 15 companies, the 8,000 individuals who did respond? I mean, broad brushstrokes, but what did you learn?
So the one thing is remarkable similarities between here and the 23 representative countries that the HBS academic surveyed is that employees want their companies to be ethical. When we look at how important employees ethics are to employees, and we've only started this initiative looking at employees, we'd like to broaden it to stakeholder perceptions other than employees. They want their companies to be ethical. What we're finding, though, is that across different dimensions that we identified, 8 dimensions that are broadly stakeholder focused, but across those dimensions, we're scoring better in some areas than others. And interestingly, it's around employee perceptions of organizational cultures and practices, as well as treatment of employees, that companies are coming up the most short. So things like customers, engagement with broader society, fairly strong on avoidance of misconduct, those corporate governance aspects and the stuff we put in the social ethics reports and that the King Commission urges us to look at, scoring a little better than what employees are perceiving themselves. What also came through really strongly is a tendency of employees not to report where they see issues. So where they do see issues of intimidation, bullying, etc., what we're finding is a number of employees are just saying, I'm too scared, they're going to be negative repercussions. And in many cases, the excos that we've worked with in organizations have been quite shocked to see this. But I think quite often we see a huge gap between what sits in the boardroom and the lived experience on the ground, and often that is interpreted through layers of management.
Completely, but no manager. I mean, this came through in the Sasol discussion we had. Bad news doesn't flow upwards. And companies are often in complete denial about the lived experience of their staff. I did a presentation to a group of women across many, many industries yesterday, and I said, who works in a toxic environment? And 50 pairs of hands went up. And every single person from different companies, and it's like, oh my goodness gracious me. And have you told your boss? Nobody had. Because
so the Harvard academics have a name for it. They call it the altitude effect. And the premise of it is that life is more rosy when viewed through the spectacles of the senior team relative to those who are in the coal faces. The question is, how do we decompress?
You're above the smog. I mean, you know, if you're in the Leonardo, the big tall building next to our studios, you know, if you're above the 30th floor of that, you're above the smog. You breathe different air and you see the world differently. What people forget and what managers and boards forget is that we're associated with the brands we represent. So if you say to somebody, oh yeah, no, I was an auditor at KPMG. I mean, it's one way to clear a room, isn't it? Simply because of the association. And we don't want to be associated with toxic brands.
You know, we had speakers this week, and one of the speakers was the Chief Justice, and he's always so wise, and he was speaking about embracing the democratic project and the good thing about freedom of expression. And one of the thoughts I was left with is that I'm not sure that we've created environments for that freedom of expression to take place in organizations. So I think we're sometimes a little behind on the democratic project. And as you say, of course, what happens then is we take that sentiment and then we express it externally. So we would much rather, as leaders, it's nicer not to hear the bad news, but it's so much healthier for our organizations to have these constructive discussions before they spill over. And, of course, your previous interview and the conversations about SAA also come in here, that we turn around and say we need to own and have these interchanges in our companies to stop that toxicity spilling out.
Nicola Klein, thank you. She is Professor Nicola Klein, the Dean at Gibbs this evening, talking about the ethics report coming out of Gibbs this week, a whole big study being done, and of course paying tribute to the patron of Gibbs, Donald Gordon, who died today at the age of 89.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Andrew Bryson from Sunland Private Wealth. All that matters this weekend, Andrew Bryson, is what S&P thinks. I mean, they've already made up their minds, and at some point in the next 6 hours, we'll make that announcement known. We're waiting on 10 Talks to see what they think of us.
Yeah, absolutely, Bruce. I think it's coming out 11 o'clock our time. Look, I think it's less important than the Moody's rating announcement next year. But certainly, I think we'll be watching from a sentiment perspective to see what the outcome is tonight.
I mean, we're expecting. They've already got us on junk, right? And they've got us on a neutral outlook. They've got two choices, well, three choices. They can either upgrade us, which they're not going to do. They can leave us on neutral. Or they can downgrade us to a negative outlook, which takes us deeper into junk. And I know you say it's less important than Moody's, but it's just the deeper they go into junk, the further we've got to climb out of the hole.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And I think the landscape remains difficult. We know what the fiscal challenges are, and they probably have deteriorated somewhat. I think from a sentiment perspective, it's certainly not good to see us get downgraded further if that's the case.
But over the last 24 hours, we've seen the currency strengthen. We've seen markets, you know, not do too badly in response to the fact that we are facing the likelihood of an outlook change. And that's because simply our money is very attractive from an investment perspective. Even though we sit on the brink of Moody's junk as well, we've got high interest rates relative to the rest of the world, and money follows returns.
Yeah, sure. I think the fact that we didn't see a rate cut yesterday does make us attractive in an environment where investors are looking for yield, and certainly in the developed market, they're not getting a real return on their money. So markets like South Africa that have an attractive yield are seeing renewed or continued interest, at least. And I think that'll continue to be the case.
And then tell me about Tiger Brands' results today. I mean, they're still feeling the aftershocks of listeriosis. This is listeriosis 3.0. They can't shake it.
Yeah, Bruce, quite a weak set or a shocker set of results. Certainly, I guess, struggling to recover from that listeriosis. Their meat business is still not doing well, or at least not recovering strongly. Revenue was fairly moderately up, I think up 3% odd. And earnings down substantially. I think they're struggling in a very competitive market. They're struggling to keep costs down, and they're struggling to pass on price increases to consumers.
Yeah, and we see that in the inflation numbers that came out on Wednesday, that food inflation remains fairly muted. What Tiger Brands has got to do is get rid of the VAMP. Oh, that's a terrible name for value-added meats products. And they're looking for a buyer.
Yeah, look, I mean, they are looking to sell it. We'll see if buyers emerge. But the business itself still has a great set of brands. And I guess they've got to do a lot of thinking around strategy there of how they can get growth going again and improve their bottom line.
That's what they have to do. My thanks to you for coming in this evening. Andrew Bryson, he is with Sundum Private Wealth. The big stories of the day, the big one, S&P Global, 11 o'clock tonight. Will they downgrade the outlook? I suspect they might. Is that in the price? I suspect it is. But the deeper we go into the junk pit, the harder it is to claw ourselves out when things do turn. And things will turn. Can't tell you when, but they will.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Well, during the 2019-2020 budget speech for the Department of Environmental Affairs, the Minister, Barbara Creasy, stated the management of single-use plastic waste is a matter that requires urgent attention. The department says teamwork is required in order to grow the plastics economy as part of the circular economy, just not a one-way trip to an environment that's increasingly harmful to health and the well-being of all South Africans. Play your part. Be part of the solution.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Coming up on your next Money Show, award-winning actor Thapelo Mokoena, the lead actor in the massively popular, very successful, brand new miniseries Trackers. Joining us in studio is our Make Money Monday special edition guest. We'll see if we can get the plot twists and turns from him as well. Ian Mann, our regular book reviewer, Talking to Strangers, the Malcolm Gladwell hit, the latest one from Malcolm Gladwell in our business book segment, plus, of course, all the big stories. And we'll follow up on the big S&P announcement too next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Time for the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. And it's been a very, 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 very busy and exciting and active week. Busisiwe Mavuso was here earlier this week, the chief executive of Business Leadership South Africa. She's also an Eskom board member, and she was telling us about the appointment of the Power Utilities new chief executive, Andre de Reiter. Now, he was, of course, appointed earlier this week, and there was widespread acceptance that this was a guy who was required. This was the board's choice. She told us he doesn't have to check with the Ministry of Public Enterprises every time he needs to make a decision. He's got the freedom to act, and we certainly hope that he does, because it's a huge and important and terrifying role.
As the CEO, we definitely have freedom to act, you know, and I think it obviously comes in and is not, you know, very well what challenges he's walking into as he comes into Eskom. You know, he knows that he has to empower the employees to stabilize the energy grid. He knows that he comes, you know, facing the pressing matter of containing the debt, which is nearing half a trillion rand mark. He knows that the revenues of Eskom are under pressure and the costs are rising. He knows that Eskom is facing a falling demand from its largest clients in this weak economy, you know, and he knows that he's expected to actually turn all of that around, you know, and he's definitely ready for it. You know, he's got the right context, not only for Eskom, but for the broader energy sector. He understands that Eskom is actually in the process of being unbundled. He's got a view in terms of what that means. He's very well versed in terms of the Eskom paper that has been released and the roadmap thereof. He knows that whilst the paper is not perfect, but it does give some clear objectives, you know, in terms of what it needs to do, you know, and he already has a plan in place and is looking forward to working with the 48,000 employees at Eskom to ensure, you know, that the financial stability and the operational challenges that face Eskom as a crisis are urgently addressed.
That is Busisiwe Mavuso, who is on the board of Eskom, reassuring us that he was the board's choice. One of the big stories of the week was the SAA strike. It has now come to an end with all kinds of T's and C's attached to a very complicated wage settlement, which boils down to 5.9%, which is what was on the table before workers lost 8 days of wages. And it'll only come in tranches over the next couple of months if and when SAA gets money. There are no guarantees in this thing. But the airline's board held a press conference earlier this week. It was really interesting to catch up with Martin Kingston, an airline board member, sharing some of the stark realities that SAA faces.
The reality is that we cannot commit to make payments or we don't have the financial wherewithal so to do. So we need to acknowledge first and foremost what a fit-for-purpose airline looks like and how we can implement it. Saying that we should pay them doesn't actually enable us to find the funds, so to do, and the sooner that that is acknowledged by everybody concerned, the sooner we can start to proceed with the organizational design work. We can look at how best to implement the turnaround strategy on an accelerated basis, and we can ensure the survival of the airline. As you say, if we fail to do that, the consequences are far more dramatic than the ones we're seeing at the moment.
Unions seem to be using a 2015 Ernst & Young report, an EY report, into evidence of corruption at SAA and saying SAA is still corrupt. Nothing has been done to remedy the situation, of which their members, who are now striking for jobs, are being treated unfairly. They are being prejudiced because of sins of the past, and SAA has not changed its spots. Your response to that?
It's absolutely incorrect. There's no doubt whatsoever that there's been a very significant amount of corruption and malfeasance that has taken place, and it may well be the case that it's still occurring today. We have assembled a very significant team, overseen by the board, of people who are prosecuting those cases. Every single one of the forensic reports that has been submitted in front of the board has been acted upon, is with the national prosecuting authorities. There are significant amounts of criminal prosecutions that are taking place or about to take place. But this takes time, as we've seen with the Zondo Commission and many other cases where malfeasance and corruption has abounded. I do not accept the contention that the board or indeed the management are doing nothing about it. We're doing everything within our power. The reality is that we have limited bandwidth to pursue everything at the same time. And actually, the strike simply distracts management from the task in hand, including prosecuting corruption.
That is the reality from a board perspective at SAA. Time for one more. Let's have a listen to Kimi Makweto, the most patient man in South Africa. I don't know how he does it without losing his sense of composure, frankly, releasing his recent report and pointing out that all 14 SOEs, state-owned enterprises, that are audited by the Auditor General had negative audits. They notched up 1.4 billion rand in irregular expenditure. There wasn't a single municipality in the Free State that didn't get a qualified audit. And qualified audit is a bad thing, by the way. There was a government department that celebrated qualified audits with cake and muffins and things a while back. It's a bad thing to be qualified when it comes to audits. I asked him whether or not we'll ever see the premiers of the provinces going to jail for bad audits, because all it does is it hides the crookery and malfeasance we know exists in so many different aspects of the state.
Well, I guess, I mean, that probably becomes a law enforcement issue that happens after investigations, for example, of these issues of irregular expenditure have been fully expedited. once all of those things are done, it should be possible in an environment that respects the rule of law for someone to be taken to the cleaners if they have been perpetuating the wrongdoing with regards to financial matters. So our case, in our case as the audit office, all we do is to provide the verifiable audit evidence that we pick up. The rest of the actions that follow from that are for other agencies as well as law enforcement.
But you'd like to see it, I'm sure. I mean, as somebody who's deeply frustrated in your day job being disregarded year after year after year, at some point accountability has to bite.
There's that part to it, Bruce. There's the other part to it, which I think is about building strong institutions. The one way that you do it is to make sure that the people assigned different leadership roles in the institution do what they are required to do, particularly when it comes to preventing systems from being abused. Because think about a situation when our economic fortunes turn around. How do we know that we will be protected from abuse if the current environment suggests that we are not protected even as we are on the low ebb as far as economic activity is concerned? So I think we need to make a choice and say that we're going to do both. We're going to start building constructively what needs to be in place at all levels, but at the same time, those that are hell-bent on consistent abuse must find themselves in orange overalls.
We wait, we wait, we wait. Thanks to Kimi Makweto, chatting to him earlier on this week. On The Money Show, those are some of the best bits. You can find our podcast every day on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Time for the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night. Who will become 91? Oh, good question. Who will become 91? That is the first question in tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz. 021-446-0567, 011-883. 0702 this evening on The Money Show. If you want to play tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz, who is becoming 91?
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that believes long-term partnerships deliver sustainable results. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
The Brutal Biz Quiz.
So Deborah Batsoffen, I'm delighted that your mother is turning 91, but that's not the answer to the first question in the Brutal Biz Quiz. Who will become 91, Tabor?
Hello, Bruce. It's going to be Investec Asset Management.
Correct. We chatted to Hendrik du Toit, the guy who will be running that listed business next year. For which packaging company does the new Eskom chief executive still work? Where does Andre de Reiter work until he joins Eskom? That's a pain and suffering's going to get you there, Tabo, I'm afraid. Greg?
Hi, Bruce. It's Nampak.
Nampak is correct, absolutely. He was the surprise candidate announced this week. Who has a business school, a hospital, a grand tier at the Royal Opera House in London named after them?
Donald Gordon.
Donald Gordon, absolutely right. Donald Gordon, the founder of Liberty, the announcement today that he has died at the age of 89. Who's taken a big chunk of the Blue Bulls?
Patrice Motsepe
also owns Mamelodi Sundowns and a whole bunch of other stuff too. And then from whom has the United Kingdom telecoms company BT, Standard Chartered Bank, tech company Cisco, accounting firm KPMG, and their mother distanced themselves this week?
Prince Andrew.
You, Greg, are the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz on this Friday night. Well done to you. Yes, Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, having everybody saying, him? We don't know him. BT, Standard Chartered Bank, Cisco, KPMG even. Even KPMG said this guy's too dodge for us. And the Queen also said, sorry, my boy, but it's just too hot for us in the kitchen right now. I don't know where the kitchen is, but it's just too hot there. As we wrap up The Money Show, let me tell you for one last time this evening, because it's just one of those nights sometimes. At least you're not Prince Andrew. I mean, the week your mother fires you and KPMG says you're too dodgy for us. I mean, really, how hard must your life be?